Thought I'd start this talk with a story. Everybody likes a good story, right? This is a story about Anattapindika. Anattapindika was one of the Buddha's followers, one of his lay followers, one of his first lay followers. He was a householder. At some point, Anattapindika bought land for the first monastery where the Buddha and the monks would stay during the rains retreats. Built the buildings, asked the Buddha if it was okay if they built buildings where the monks could stay. The Buddha said yes, and he built this monastery, and over the years supported the Buddha, very generous in supporting the Buddha and the monks. At some point, the Buddha said to Anattapindika, you know, you've been really great. I mean, you've supported us. You've been so generous. Now it's time to move to the next level of your practice, and you really have to develop your meditation practice and really learn to develop jhana. And he taught Anattapindika and the other lay people the steps of breath meditation. And then the story leads us to the end of Anattapindika's life. Anattapindika was dying and was visited by Sariputta. Sariputta was one of the Buddha's foremost disciples and taught a lot, and a lot of suttas with his teaching. So Sariputta went to see Anattapindika and sat down by his bedside, and Anattapindika was dying, and he said, I'm dying, and I'm in great pain. And Sariputta proceeded to give Anattapindika the wisdom teachings. So taught Anattapindika about suffering and clinging and the five aggregates and so forth. And as he was giving this teaching, Anattapindika began to cry and the tears poured down his face. Sariputta stopped and he said, you know, why are you crying? Are you failing? Are you about to leave us now? And Anattapindika said, no, I'm crying because I've never heard these teachings before. These are such beautiful teachings and such important teachings, and I've never heard them before. And Sariputta said, well, you know, we usually don't give these teachings to the lay people. And so Anattapindika said, well, you need to give these teachings to the lay people. There's some of us who will understand it. There's some of us who have just a little dust in our eyes. So it said that from then on, the wisdom teachings were given to the householders. To me, it's a very important story because I think myself, like a lot of us, feel that as householders, we're not going to be able, you know, we have these doubts at times about our ability to develop the wisdom that's necessary to develop to find freedom from our suffering, to develop insight into some of these very complex teachings like the five aggregates. But the Buddha, but from the time of Anattapindika on, these teachings have been given to householders. And it's always been made clear by the Buddha and the monks and all the teachers who followed that householders can develop this liberating wisdom. You know, those of us with just a little dust in our eyes. Dust in our eyes, just a little. You know, if you think about Anattapindika as somebody with just a little dust in his eyes, well, what does that mean? What does it mean for us? It means that we understand that happiness in life comes from our actions. You know? And, you know, we learn these teachings so that we can develop more skillful actions. You know, that was very, very clearly expressed in the way that Anattapindika practiced generosity. Because you know, most people don't think that way, don't think that happiness comes from their actions, from taking actions that are informed by love and compassion. The taking of the action that we've taken today and coming here, you know, is an action taken by people with just a little dust in their eyes. You know, most people wouldn't have the clarity and the understanding to be able to know that coming here is of great value to do this. You know, it's like you need to have that to be able to get here. So sometimes we think, well, you know, I'm not able to develop this kind of wisdom. If you are here, you have a hell of a lot of wisdom, you know. Yeah, because you understand the way to happiness. You understand that these teachings can lead you to happiness. Not because it's the Buddha's teachings or it's Buddhism or it's downtown meditation. Yeah, but the teachings themselves, the truth that the teachings lead us to. You know, we all understand that to some level. We wouldn't have spent a whole day here. And we develop this clarity. We wipe away the dust in our eyes by developing concentration. So, you know, these were the things that Anatta Pindika did. You know, he understood the Buddhist teachings and the teachings of, you know, skillfulness. You know, there was no Buddhism at the time. It was the teachings that the Buddha was giving. Take skillful action. Practice generosity. Then he taught him to develop concentration. So we develop this concentration as a way of wiping away the dust in our eyes, you know, so that we can see more clearly. This is a practice of, you know, these three elements, right? Developing your skillful qualities and skillful action, developing concentration, and developing insight. Now, the teachings that at the end of his life that Sariputta gave to Anatta Pindika were the wisdom teachings, the teachings pertaining to the skills that we're asked to develop so that we can develop noble wisdom or liberating wisdom, transcendent wisdom. Of course, those teachings all fall within the footprint of the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths is the overarching teaching, the overarching wisdom, truth that we're asked to develop in the service of finding freedom from our suffering. So in our practice, you know, ultimately we work with the Four Noble Truths to develop these Four Noble Truths, which really are actions, beginning with seeing our suffering, specifically the suffering that's caused by clinging, the clinging that's rooted in aversion and desire. This is what the Buddha said is really the cause of our suffering in life. You know, and that means that just that, it causes us dis-ease and stress and suffering, but it also prevents us from taking action that is informed by the heart, action that will lead to a true happiness. That's really what suffering is about, ultimately, is what we're doing is preventing us from knowing a true happiness. So, you know, we have a little bit of dust in our eyes, we come here because doing what we're doing is going to help us find a true happiness. So this suffering that's really caused by clinging to a desire and aversion. You know, if it's the aversion about the pain in the body or the aversion about the way your practice is going, or the desire you were caught up in today and holding on to or in your life, you know, or, you know, all those different forms. Maybe it's anxiety around something that you have to do, or anxiety or about something that you've done in the past. You know, this is what we're asked to see, you know, that our suffering is caused by holding on to aversion and desire. Clinging, feeding on aversion and desire in all of its different forms. And seeing that, learning to let go of clinging, learning not to cling. Yeah? I mean, that's what the Buddha came to understand. If we ceased to cling, if we no longer engaged in clinging and holding on to aversion and desire, we would know happiness in this life. We'd be free from that pain. You know, if you look at your pain in your life, that's where it comes from. Yeah? If you look at your pain, and that's what you're asked to do, that's where it comes from. Holding on to aversion and desire, holding on to the qualities that are subsets or the tributaries, the anxiety and the dissatisfaction and the disappointment and the wanting. It's all caused by, so this is what we're asked to see. This is the wisdom teachings. See this. He was talking to Anatta Pindika, of course, who, his suffering was around a lot of the pain, the physical sensations in the body, and the pain around dying, the holding on to the aversion to that, the desire for the things in our lives that we want and will no longer have. So it's through the letting go or the abandonment of clinging that we come to know happiness in this life. So the real question, of course, is how do we let go of clinging? How do we not cling? Sometimes we tend to think that, oh, I see that I'm clinging, I just need to let go. Has that ever worked for you? Has that ever worked for you? I'm just going to try to let go. It's not what the Buddha taught. What he taught was we abandon clinging through wisdom, through insight. That's what Sariputta taught Anatta Pindika, develop that insight that will enable you to abandon your clinging. Clinging to the form, clinging to the feeling tones of pleasant and unpleasant sensation, clinging to the perceptions that we have about ourselves and others, clinging to the thinking. The way to abandon clinging is through insight, through wisdom. So, how do we develop the insight that leads to letting go? Well, it's through mindfulness, right? It's through mindfulness. It's being mindful of certain things, putting our attention on certain things, beginning with our suffering and clinging, the suffering that we're causing ourselves by holding on. So we pay close attention. We look closely at our suffering. We look and see, well, there's the experience of the body or the experience of the mind as we come to know it as it manifests as form in the body. There's the experience of aversion. I don't like the way the day is going, or I don't like what I'm going to have to do later on today. And there's the holding on to that, because that's not the problem, right? The problem isn't the aversion or the desire. The problem is the holding on to it. So we're asked to look and see. This is insight. Look and see that there's two separate things there. There's aversion and there's the holding on to it. There's the disliking of the sensation in the knee and the holding on to the disliking. This is what we're asked to see. And then what we're asked to see is the drawbacks in the holding on. Well, are there drawbacks in holding on to this aversion? Are there drawbacks in holding on to this desire? Are there drawbacks right now in this moment? But that's not intellectual. That's experiencing, knowing the drawbacks in the moment of holding on. Are there drawbacks in this moment, and are there drawbacks in the long haul? What are the long-term consequences of this holding on? What are the long-term consequences of the holding on to aversion and desire and disliking and wanting that you engaged in today? Because all of that holding on that you did today caused you suffering today, but will also lead, consequently, to suffering in the future. Will lead to you being afflicted in the future. Will lead to your affliction, an affliction that will block you off from your heart, will lead to your not being able to discern what are actions that are in support of your heart, in support of your wish to be happy, will lead to you not being able to take action that's in support of your wish to be happy. Those are the consequences. That's what we're asked to see. That's what we're asked to see. That's what we're asked to know. That's what we're asked to see. That's what we're asked to know. You know, we need, in order to see that, you know, we need to have just a little dust in our eyes. We're asked to see the drawbacks in what we're holding on to, the objects, the desire and aversion itself, or the sensations in the body themselves, that they're just impermanent, they're not self, they're just conditioned, they don't have to be held on to. They don't have to be held on to. Their nature is to come and go. We just keep holding on to them. So we're asked to look and to see that. We're asked to look very closely and see on the most refined level, a very, very, very complex teaching, but the one the Buddha gave most, one of the teachings that Sariputta gave to Anattapindika, the very complex teaching into how when we cling, manifests as five different kinds of clinging. You know, there's the clinging to the experience of the aversion, and the holding on to the felt sensation, and then there's the clinging to the way that it feels. It's unpleasant, and then there's the clinging to the perception that arises out of it. You know, the perception about, you know, that arises out of that aversion towards what we have to do later on. Oh, that's really going to be a terrible thing to have to do. It's going to be awful. I can't do that. Whatever it is, you know, we're asked to look into that clinging and then the clinging to all the stories, the thoughts, the narratives that come out of that. So our job is to pay attention to our suffering, to look, to investigate, to pay close attention to it, to pay close attention to it. You know, it's not a cursory look. It's paying close attention to it, close attention to it. And that requires concentration. What does that mean, right? Well, you know, the Buddha said it requires a very specific kind of concentration. You know, one that you're able to stay centered and that you have a center in the body, but two, that there's also a quality of ease and pleasure in the body that is there, that you've cultivated and that's accessible to you. Because if you don't have that, you can't look at your suffering. You can't look at your suffering unless you have an abiding that's easeful, that's pleasurable. And it requires this concentration, the quality of tranquility or serenity. You know, we have to look at our suffering with serenity. I always say a good indication that you are able to look, or somebody is able to look and investigate their suffering and clinging with serenity, a good indication about where they are is, how do they talk about it? How do they talk about their suffering? You know, is there agitation in talking about it? Is there a disliking of it? Is there a frustration around their suffering? Is there an upset? Or is there a calm, composed serenity? A calm, composed serenity. That's what's required. That's what you need if you want to look really closely. There needs to be that stillness. If you think about looking and seeing and developing insight is listening. You know, to really hear what we need to hear, there needs to be quiet, silence, stillness. And it's a concentration that requires, that is, includes equanimity. You know, that there's space, that we're able to look at our suffering, as the Buddha said, very specifically, like one person looking at another. I always say a good indication that you have space is you're able to look at your suffering and there isn't a movement in the mind toward wanting to get rid of it. Or if that movement arises out of past conditions, you're able to see it and put it to the side. That's when you know if you don't have enough equanimity to look at your suffering, is you're looking at it probably in the service of wanting to get rid of it, not investigation. Or perhaps ostensibly you're looking at it in the service of investigation, but you still want to get rid of it when you look at it. Got to develop your equanimity. Got to develop your equanimity. That's through breath meditation. So if we don't have those qualities, you know, we're going to want to get rid of our suffering. And that's not our job. Our job is to pay attention to our suffering, our clinging, is to develop understanding. So being mindful, seeing clearly, this is suffering, this is clinging. I'm clinging to this aversion, to this desire, to this disliking, to this wanting, to this anxiety, to this dissatisfaction, fill in the blank. This is what it's like when I'm clinging and I'm holding on, paying close attention to that. Beginning to start to ask, what are the long-term consequences of this holding on? And you say, well, how do I know? Well, you keep asking those questions, and then after you've asked those questions 20, 30,000 times over the period of 5, 10, and 20 years, and you ask that question, well, then you know what the consequences of that holding on, because you have that reference point. All those 20,000 times that you asked that question before, you say, oh yeah, now I see what the consequences of having held on are. Now I understand. Now I see clearly. So we have to ask those questions. What are the long-term consequences? I want to be happy in my life. There's things I want to do. I want to fulfill my wish to be happy. All the dreams I had when I was 9 years old on the playground. Holding on to that anxiety, that dissatisfaction, that wanting. Can we see that that's standing in the way of that, preventing us from that? Seeing clearly, this is what I'm clinging to. What am I clinging to? Is it permanent? Is it self? Is it a fixed part of who I am? I mean, if it is, then you're kind of screwed, you know? But if it isn't, then there's the potential for not holding on to it and letting it go. Not creating conditions by which it'll continue to arise and you'll continue to hold on to it. So our job is to look, to observe, to pay close attention. You know, one of the ways that we learn to do that is how. Where do we first learn to do that? Step two, right? By looking at the breath. Dis-ease and ease. It's the same thing, you know? It's like, if you gotta learn to do that, you know, with the breath, and if you can do that with the breath, and if you develop that very fine and refined sensitivity to dis-ease and ease in the breath, you know, then you'll be able to do that in terms of the dis-ease and ease around holding on to suffering, holding on to aversion and desire and dissatisfaction and anxiety. So we learn to pay close attention and really take an interest. Really take an interest. It's like, I don't want to do step two. I can go right to step three and I can open up to that full body. It's like, no, you have to understand. You've got to learn to develop that skill of insight, of learning to look and to be sensitive to dissonance. That's why you practice that step, ultimately. So our job is to look, to pay close attention, to take an interest in the object of aversion, desire, anxiety, and the holding on to it, not to try to eliminate it. That's not your job. I mean, there's kind of a certain conceit, the Buddha said, in thinking that you could abandon it, you know? What you can do is develop insight. Now, often what happens when we're looking and we're paying close attention, right? We don't see anything happen. Nothing is happening. I'm looking and paying close attention, but I still am holding on and I still want to hold on. Nothing is happening, and we get disappointed or frustrated or impatient. Well, that disappointment and frustration and impatience around nothing happening is an impediment to seeing clearly. It's an impediment to seeing that you're holding on and what the consequences of that holding on are. It's an impediment to clear seeing. And it's one of the things that helps us with this process of looking and not seeing anything happening is what we sometimes call right view. And right view in this case is much, most, or perhaps all of what's happening we can't see. And this is a basic tenet in the Buddha's teaching on insight, is that you pay close attention and you can't see the development of insight in most cases. You're developing insight, but you're just not seeing any changes. And the classic metaphor he gave is somebody who has an axe. You get a brand new axe. Maybe you can do this next weekend, get an axe. And you take that new axe and you chop a bunch of wood. You chop wood for a half an hour. You look at the handle of the axe after you're done. It's like it looks the same. It's not the same though, right? It's kind of worn away a little bit. You do it again and again. It still looks the same. Then you use that axe for 2 or 3 or 4 years, and you see it's all worn away. I can see my handprint there. That's how insight develops. Most of what's happening, you can't see. It's like in my apartment. I moved into my apartment 20 years ago, and I have my desk. Some of you have been there, and I have the chair with the little rollers on the bottom. I mean, I don't know how many hours I've spent in that chair. I mean, I wrote 2 books sitting in that chair. I've been, you know, it's like there's a big gouge in the wooden floor. You know, where those rollers, you know, but the first 2 or 3 years, there was nothing there. It was those rollers going back and forth on that floor countless times for 20 years. Now there's a big crater in the floor. See, that's insight. Now I can see it. Now I can see it, but I couldn't see it before. So it's important to understand that's how insight develops. We keep looking and we let go of the results and we cultivate patience. And this is why patience is one of the 10 paramis. I mean, it requires this extraordinary patience. I'm just going to be patient. And it requires faith, right? It requires faith that I'm doing this and something is happening even though I can't see it. That's a good definition of faith, right? It's faith, what is that? Well, what does faith mean? Faith in the Buddha's awakening. That's what the Buddha did, it worked for him. Maybe it'll work for me too. Then, of course, after you do it for a while and you do get that crater in the floor where the will, and then you start, then faith starts to become verified. Oh, yeah, that really does work that way. But at first, it's just you have to have faith in the Buddha's awakening. So we just keep looking day after day after day. We keep looking in this way. We look at our suffering. We look at our clinging. We ask those questions day after day after day, week after week after week, year after year after year. That's what you got to do. See, that's, you know who does that? You know who does that? People with a little dust in their eyes. You know, you just keep doing it. You keep doing it. It's like I always say, it's like, I'm no smarter than anybody, you know? I just, dumb enough to just keep showing up year after year after year and keep doing it. You know, it's just that dogged persistence, you know, that determination. That's why determination is one of the great skillful qualities, one of the paramis. You know, this is what has to be done. It's just like if you want to be a concert musician or a great artist, you got to practice, practice, practice. You keep doing it. and you take joy in it. There's a great joy in it. You know, this is the great Dharma joy of doing what has to be done. Being a happy warrior. Fighting the good fight. You know, it's like you came to this retreat today and you did all this work and it was like, I don't see any great insights, nothing. I didn't have any white light experiences, you know. A couple people may have. The room didn't, you know. It's like, but you take joy in doing what had to be done. You've done what you've had to do to develop the insight that little by slowly will develop. And gradually, insight develops. It's that gradual awakening. You know, and gradually, you pay attention and you pay attention. And you experience your suffering and your clinging in the body, and you begin to know in the body. You begin to know, oh yeah, this is the consequence of having held on to that aversion for the last 15, 20 years. You know that because you experience that in the body. You know that on that bodily level. And somebody in the class a couple of weeks ago had that insight. We were talking about this, and you know, they raised their hand and said, it's all about knowing it in the body. That she had an insight right there. She goes, oh, that's how it happens, because that's where insight happens. It's not here. It's in the body and in the heart. The more you know it in the body, then you begin to know it in the heart. So you just keep practicing. You keep practicing. It's like that Rumi poem. Rumi said, work, keep digging your well. Don't think about getting off from work. Water is there somewhere. Submit to a daily practice. Your loyalty to that is a ring on the door. Keep knocking, and the joy inside will eventually open a window and look out to see who's there. Another way the Buddha described the development of insight, he said it's like the ocean floor. You know, the ocean floor, very incrementally, imperceptibly inclines downward from the shore, and the floor of the ocean, right? From the ocean shore, the floor of the ocean gradually inclines down, and then there's a drop-off. See, that's when insight happens. There's a drop-off, you know? I mean, it's happening, but then there's a drop-off, and we see, we know. So what happens is, you know, gradually, little by slowly, we develop disenchantment with holding on. You know, and little by slowly, over time, all of a sudden, you start to realize, I'm not really as interested as I used to be in holding on to that anxiety. I'm not interested as I used to be in holding on to that aversion. Part of me still wants to, you know, but I'm not quite as interested in holding on to it. I'm a little bit disenchanted. And that disenchantment grows over time, over time. And my experience with that disenchantment is like, you know, it's like all of a sudden one day I noticed, wow, I'm less enchanted with this aversion or this desire and this anxiety. Where did that come from? That happened so suddenly. Oh, the last 20 years, what have I been doing? You know, that's what happened. But it's like, oh my God, where'd that come from? Well, it comes from looking, paying close attention, little by slowly. You know, the more wisdom you start to develop and you start to develop a little disenchantment, because, you know, that'll develop slowly too, and the disenchantment develops slowly, and when it does and there's less holding on, I mean, you could even see it on a day long. Like when I first used to come to day longs, it was like everything used to piss me off. You know, and I'd have so much anger about the person sitting next to me and the lighting and my chair and my cushion and the blanket and the towel and, you know, and it was like, now it's like, I'm not going to go into that. You know, why would I want to go into that? That's going to prevent me from developing concentration. And, you know, it's like you start to see there's more disenchantment with that. That took a while, but those are great areas where you start to see that. So once you start to develop more wisdom and more disenchantment with the aversion and desire, then your concentration starts. You know, once I started to be able to do that on the retreats, then I started to develop a little concentration. And, You know, so the more disenchantment, wisdom, disenchantment you develop, then your concentration gets stronger and you're more in the body and there's more stillness and more stillness. And then there's more wisdom and more disenchantment and more concentration and greater stillness. Because there's a great stillness that's required to know, a great silence. That's why we come here, to come to know that silence. And wisdom happens in the place of silence and stillness. So we come more and more into the body. The concentration develops. We're more and more in the body, and we're more and more in the heart. We're more and more in the heart. I always love what Ajahn Lee said. I talked about it on our retreat in last April. You know what he says. You know, and we've had that experience. We know that experience. As concentration deepens and strengthens, awareness converges in the heart. You know, all of your awareness comes right in here, into the citta. Right? You, people who've done longer retreats know that, right? At the end of the retreat, why do I love everybody all of a sudden? Because your awareness is converged right in here on the heart. And that's what happens as kind, you know, when you are fully enlightened, then your awareness will be right in here, right in the heart all the time. But more and more our awareness is converging into the heart. You know, what do we mean by the heart? Well, that's our place of innate wisdom. You know, because that's where liberating insight resides, is right here in the heart. What Ajahn Chah calls the one who knows. You know, we know the truth in the heart. We know the truth in the heart. The truth is in the heart. It's about the little by slowly coming into the heart and knowing the truth in the heart. I like to say it's like seeing your suffering with the heart, seeing your clinging with the heart, seeing the pain with the heart. You know, when the heart sees the truth and your innate wisdom flourishes, the heart responds with compassion. The heart responds with compassion. And we don't hold on out of compassion. We don't hold on out of compassion for ourselves, because we have a wish to be free from suffering. So there, as I said, there may still be that wanting to hold on, but we get to the point where our compassion is greater than our wanting to hold on. It overrides our wanting to hold on. It's like, I really want to hold on to this, but I love myself too much. I want to be happy. I want to be free. I want to be free. When we get to that point, we let go. Metaphor the Buddha used for that, letting go, he said it's like a ship that's been at sea for months and months and months. You know, a ship, like, you know, a sailing ship, with ropes that hold up the masts, you know, and the ship has been at sea for months and months and months, and then it goes on to the, you know, and all the water and everything that happens, you know, you seamen know what that's like, and then in the rainy season, the ship is on land, and the rain and the wind batter it, you know, and that happens for years and years, and gradually over time, those ropes, those big ropes, you ever see the ropes on boats, and you know, gradually they start to wither over time they wither, and then finally they break apart. He said, just as when an ocean-going ship rigged with masts and stays after 6 months on the water is left on shore for the winter, its stays, those are the ropes, weathered by the heat and wind, moistened by the clouds of the rainy season, easily wither and rot away. In the same way, when a monk dwells devoting himself to development, his fetters easily wither and rot away. So the ropes that are binding us wither and break, and we're free.